Welcome to the TARDIS Library, a place to talk comics, novels, audios and more from the worlds of Doctor Who.
G'day everyone, welcome to the TARDIS Library and indeed welcome to 2017. It's New Year's Day 2017 as I record this. I'm sitting here with some great material from longtime contributor Kevin Jordan, new contributor Mike Sulko. Welcome to the team, Mike, and some thoughts from myself on some recent Doctor Who related releases. So why don't we get into it? I want to start off by talking about the Doctor Who Annual 2017. Now, I know Doctor Who Annuals might seem a bit kiddie for people out there. You may have given up buying them back when you were a kid. For me, I've had an interesting life with the annuals. I got the 1986 annual, the one with Colin Baker on the cover. It was the second Colin Baker annual, actually, when that was current. Unfortunately, it was the last annual of its kind for a very long time. So I have this funny sort of situation where I became a big fan of Doctor Who, and there was an annual, and I bought it, and this is great. And funnily enough, just as the show started to take a bit of an upswing with the McCoy era, there were no Sylvester McCoy annuals, not for 87, not for 88, not for 89, not for any of those years. There were, however, some yearbooks, as they were called. These were similar to annuals, but not quite. There were five in total, numbered from 1992 through to 1996. They're quite rare. I have one of them. Well, when I say rare, they're rarer than the traditional Doctor Who annuals, I should say. I sometimes see the 92 and the 96 ones out there on eBay. I seldom see the 93 and 94 ones, and it's the 95 one that I own. So they are out there. But then the annuals, of course, returned in late 2005 with the first one, Christopher Eccleston on the cover, marked Annual 2006, which was kind of problematic given that Eccleston wasn't the Doctor in 2006, but never mind. It was great to have annuals back. It harked back to the more traditional annuals and it was quite good. Unfortunately, since then, the annuals over the past decade, now that I say that out loud, it seems even longer than I thought it was, the annuals over the past decade have become very, a lot more kid-oriented, a lot less original artwork, a lot less stories, a lot less of the things that I used to really like in them, and they've become just very garish, almost puzzle-type books with very little content in them to really write home about. I've become really disappointed with them in recent years particularly, and have pondered, should I still collect these? And it seems such a shame because I have, you know, most of the Doctor Who annuals going back to the 60s on my shelves now, and it's like, well, it's a nice piece of merchandise. There is sometimes something nice in them. Oh, do I keep collecting or not? And as a collector, you can tell I keep collecting. So I've bought the 2017 annual, and I'm here to tell you it is very kid-oriented. It would be fantastic if you were, I don't know, I don't really understand small children, maybe 8 years old or 10 years old, maybe if you were 12, basically around those younger sort of ages, it would probably be really, really fun. But for an older fan, it's less fun. It is more merchandise for the sake of merchandise, and I hate doing that, but annuals are one of those funny things that I've collected for a long time, so I just have to keep going. So, you want to know what's worthwhile in it? Well, there is a River Song timeline. This is done quite well over 2 pages. You actually have to turn the annual up around the other way to sort of look at it properly, and they've gone through and they've plugged Riversong's timeline in order, in the order that Riversong would have lived it. And I'm sure someone's tried to do this online before, but here it's presented really nicely, concisely, and I quite liked it. And in each box, obviously this is going in River's order, there is a number, and if you look at all the different numbers, they're the numbers that the Doctor met her in. So you can sort of see it from both sides, the mixed up garbled way the Doctor met her and the way that she experienced life from obviously a young girl, those early regenerations, giving up her regenerations and so on and so forth. I know River Song isn't the most popular of characters with a lot of people these days. They feel she's been a bit overused. But for those of you who like River Song, or even just want to get your head around the timeline from where she started through to the 24-year night on Deryllium, it's actually really good. I found it quite a useful thing. What else? There is a story in this book. It's not a traditional story because it's told in the format of emails. I guess that's quite a modern thing, although funnily enough, kids these days don't really use emails much, do they? I read that recently. Yeah, interesting. I guess it's written by a slightly older person who still thinks email is really current and it's what kids do. Anyway, let's put that aside. This story is told through emails, and Missy, posing as Miss Magister, there's one for the old school fans, is running a school, and it's emails from a student back to her parents saying what's happening at the school and her encounters with Missy and the things Missy is doing at this school. And yes, it's for kids, but it's actually quite well written and it's quite entertaining. And it took me back to earlier annuals where, you know, stories were just a staple of the earlier annuals. And I really enjoyed reading it. It wasn't a complete waste of time like so many of the other pages are with the puzzles and things like that on them. There's also two comics. They're well drawn. They're not super realistic, but they're not quite cartoony either, if that makes sense. They're quite pretty to look at. And one of the two is very good. It's called The Promise. And the premise of The Promise, if I can put it that way, is really interesting. It could actually be expanded out to be a proper TV story or novel. Obviously, compacted into a few pages of comic, it loses something. But the core, the crux of the story is there. And essentially, it's that as we've seen the Doctor do through many adventures in time and space, he protects people and comes back to help them in their time of need. And here, that is happening with a young man, and he grows up to essentially become a dictator on his planet because he is protected. He has this aura around him that he is protected, almost like a chosen one, so the people are following him. There's a bit more to it than that. I'll leave it to you to actually read to find out how he's controlling the population beyond being just protected. But this idea that the Doctor could be thinking he's doing something good and protecting somebody, and that actually enables this person to go out and do evil in, well, not in the Doctor's name, but because of something the Doctor is doing, that's really, really fascinating to me, and that could become the plot for a TV story or a novel, as I say. I found it really, you know, it's a kid's comic. Let's get down to brass tacks. It's a kid's comic, but I'm flicking through it thinking, wow, this is a great story. This is giving me all sorts of ideas. I'd like to see this taken further, and that's a really cool thing. You can't expect what's in these annuals to be really adult or really, really in-depth or anything like that, but the thoughts this story gave me were quite good. I mean, compared to the other comic in the annual, it's Chalk and Cheese, the other comic, the Doctor is essentially getting from one end of one room to another, and there's sort of a deadly maze in the middle, and he's doing it with an elephant, with I think it was a psychic trunk, and when he gets scared, the trunk wraps around the Doctor. It's all quite weird, very kiddie. As I say, these two comics in the one annual are Chalk and Cheese. This other one is quite interesting in comparison. They're probably the three big things: the River Song timeline, the Missy story set via emails, and one of the two comics. Aside from that, it's all the puzzly sort of stuff, and, you know, garishly put together with a lot of publicity photos that you've seen many times before, and you just know not as much care's gone into it as past annuals. You know, you go and pull out the 1978 annual or the 1981 annual or, you know, whatever you like, and there's well-written stories and there's a lot of hand-drawn artwork, which although can look quite weird at times, is charming and has had time spent on it. The only time a lot of this has had spent on it is a graphic designer just working with stock art assets and just laying it all out in a very, as I say, a very garish way. That's about the best way I can put it. So, on the whole, if I was, let's say, 10 years old, I would think this annual was really great. I would have loved to have got this under the Christmas tree. It would have all sorts of interesting things to read throughout. As an adult, of course, I'm just collecting it for the sake of having my annual collection be up to date. Although I was quite interested in a few of the bits. As I say, that comic story, The Promise, is actually well worth going into. I don't know how it can be expanded at this point in time. I don't think it would become a TV story or would become a novel, but just the premise of The Promise is fantastic. Anyway, what about you out there? Have you bought the 2017 annual? I know when it came to the 2016 annual, not too long into January, I had friends in the UK, particularly friends doing other podcasts, saying that they'd seen it in remaindered bookstores for 50 pence and so on. So if you're in the UK, you might get lucky again. It seems Capaldi-based merchandise doesn't sell all that well, and you may see it for cheap. Or did you get it for Christmas? I don't know. Are you reading it over in the US of A? You might be. Who knows? Write in. Let us know what you thought of the annual. Our email address is hello@thedwshow.net, and we'll read out what you thought of the annual on our next episode, which should be later in January, I'd say, at this point in time. Now, look, I've spoken enough here. I'll come back at the end of the show. But for now, have a listen to our new contributor, Mike Sulko, who's going to talk about some Big Finish audios. After Mike, we'll have Kevin Jordan, and then I'll join you again to close out the show.
Hi, I'm Mike Sulko, formerly of the Time Scoop podcast, which is currently stuck somewhere in a time eddy. Maybe it'll break out again someday. But I'm here to bring you some reviews of Big Finish audio plays. Particularly, I'm going to be bringing you whatever the current story is from the main range, which is the monthly range they do every month, as well as occasionally sidestepping over to some of the tangential materials or box sets featuring other doctors along the way. The monthly range has been really the backbone of the Big Finish productions over the last 15 plus years, and traditionally they feature the 5th Doctor, 6th Doctor, and 7th Doctors. The 8th Doctor used to be a part of the range, but he really hasn't been for several years. They've kind of moved him over to doing box set stuff on his own. And so most of what I'm going to be talking about is 5, 6, and 7. It's interesting because the 5th Doctor stories can vary quite a bit depending on who his companions are in a given tale. The 6th Doctor stories have really been kind of the highlight of the range. They've really done a lot of salvaging of that character. I know he wasn't necessarily the most popular when it came to the TV series, even though it's no fault of Colin Baker's. And they found a way to really just emphasize what's great about that character and make him work. Then there's the 7th Doctor stories, and the 7th Doctor is my favorite of the 12 Doctors we have, but unfortunately his audios can be kind of hit and miss along the way. So sometimes they're really fantastic, other times they just don't hit the mark. So it'll be interesting to see kind of over the series how that all builds up, and I look forward to bringing you these reviews every month. And the first story I'm going to be talking to you about is The Order of the Daleks, which came out this December 2016. It's written by Mike Tucker, who was a special effects guy back in the Sylvester McCoy era, and he also has written several Doctor Who novels over the years. He's written some Big Finish plays in the past, so he's been involved in a lot of different facets of Doctor Who over the last 25 years or so. Then you have the director Jamie Anderson, who's done quite a few of the Big Finish plays. This story stars Colin Baker as the Doctor and Miranda Rayson as Constance Clark, who prefers to be referred to as Mrs. Clark. She's very, very strong about that. She makes that clear to everyone. And this story involves a planet called Strelan. It's a Class 3 world, which is basically to say a primitive non-technological society. And it's populated by the Brotherhood of the Black Petal. It's an order of monks who really, they can commune with nature. And they're very at one with each other. And there's kind of maybe some psychic stuff going on there. And of course, as the title tells you, the Daleks are involved. Now, it's not really a spoiler to say, these Daleks that we see in the story are made of stained glass. What happens is their ship crashes on the planet, the unsuspecting Brotherhood gets involved, and unfortunately, they make these beautiful, beautiful casings. The design work for these is fantastic. I mean, they're made out of wrought iron with these stained glass panels, and it's interesting because it makes the Daleks fragile in a way, but at the same time, they're still threatening. They don't have their blasters necessarily, but they have some instruments they could use to maybe spear you or things like that. So it's different, you know, because the Doctor's not a character who runs around with a gun in the first place, so these Daleks can still be threatening. They find ways to raise the stakes with the Daleks despite their limitations, and I'm not sure that those stakes ever really feel earned or just a solid part of the story. I'm kind of a little sad because I was really excited to come on and start talking about Big Finish Productions. It's probably my favorite form of Doctor Who at the moment, and unfortunately this is a story that just doesn't hit the mark. It feels very much like paint-by-numbers Doctor Who. It feels like you could insert any Doctor, any companion into this story, and nothing would change. And to me, that's the worst type of Doctor Who. I would rather see an experiment fail badly as opposed to something that just kind of does the job and, you know, it's Doctor Who and it's 2 hours and it takes up your time, and that's really about all there is to say for it. Now, part of the problem is the supporting characters. You have the monks who, again, it's an interesting premise, this Brotherhood of the Black Petal, and unfortunately the monks just never fit past stereotypical roles that we see them introduced as. Of course, there's the monk who's kind of very wise and he's willing to help the doctor. There's several characters who are against the doctor and just very stern. You have a couple of younger twins who show about as much personality as the twins in Twin Dilemma. It's unfortunate. You also have the only other two characters that are maybe coming from outside the society. You have a couple of census takers. They're called assessors. You have Pendle, who's very much a bureaucratic red tape guy, and he's also very cowardly. He's at odds with Colin Baker throughout the entire story. Then you also have his assistant assessor named Asta. And Asta is kind of training to become an assessor, and she's more willing to help the Doctor and Mrs. Clark along the way. Typical with Doctor Who stories, they kind of branch out in different directions. You have Mrs. Clark goes out with Asta and kind of does some side stuff, and then the Doctor and Pendle are at each other's throats the whole time, kind of off doing their own thing as well. And it's unfortunate because whereas Pendle just is very much a stereotype and doesn't raise above or doesn't really challenge your expectations at all, Asta's actually a more interesting character than Mrs. Clark. And perhaps this is my lack of background with Mrs. Clark. This is only the second story I've heard with her. Apparently she's a royal nurse from the Navy back around World War II in Britain. But aside from kind of some vague things she says along the way about maybe this is only going to last for so long, there's no character development. There's nothing to really give me a background as far as why I should care about this character. Anything like that. And that's also frustrating because you have to kind of remember that every story is going to be somebody's first to a degree. And it's not fair to expect that every story is going to give a full introduction to these new companions, but at the same time, a little bit more about her background would have been nice just so I could feel more on board with it. And so yeah, when you have a supporting character that's actually challenging and surpassing the companion in many ways as far as quality goes, that doesn't help the story at all either. Again, you could have slotted in Perry or Sarah Jane or any companion really, and they would have done exactly the same job as Mrs. Clark. Here. So again, what is there about this character that's unique? This paint-by-numbers Doctor Who is just really frustrating to me because I think that there's so many ideas here that had potential. The Brotherhood of the Black Petal, having stained glass Daleks, things like that. And the fact that it never congeals and never comes together in a way that's exciting in any way. Even the climax of the story just feels very perfunctory. So I guess it's just like I said, is I'd rather see something that challenges me and maybe fails as opposed to something that's just straightforward Doctor Who. So if I was to give this one a rating, I would give this one 5 TARDISes out of 10. And it's kind of unfortunate because, again, it's not a bad story. It's just not a good story either. And again, if I'm going to be paying for a monthly Doctor Who thing, I'd really like to get something that is quality and really challenges my expectations of Doctor Who. I would recommend this one if you're a fan of the classic series and you're just looking forward to kind of a straightforward adventure that's going to kill 2 hours. You know, if you are a fan of Colin Baker, he has a few nice moments here and there. So don't get me wrong, it's not terrible. It's just not great. There's lots of better examples out there. Now, the good news about this is that Big Finish dropped a Christmas surprise, and they released The Diary of Riversong Volume 2 early this year. Now, The Diary of Riversong is a series of box sets. This is the second, of course. And they did one previously last year, which was extremely high quality. It was really great to see Riversong having her own adventures. They found a way to include the Eighth Doctor without the Eighth Doctor becoming the focus of the story, and that was greatly appreciated. So now they're back with another season. So I'm going to be talking to you about The Unknown by Guy Adams. It's the first story in the set, directed by Ken Bentley, who also has done, of course, a lot of Doctor Who work for the audio range. And this story features Alex Kingston as Riversong back in the role. And it also has the Seventh Doctor in the story, Sylvester McCoy. It's very interesting to bring up this kind of scenario because from what we know, they shouldn't know each other. I mean, it's possible Riversong has met these past Doctors, but it's really unfeasible that Seventh Doctors met her along the way and just forgot by the time he was in his 10th incarnation. So there's already a genie that they have to find a way to put back in the bottle somehow, or they need to find out a clever trick to be able to get around this. The story itself features a crew on a spaceship, and it's a very small crew, only 3 people, a commander, a pilot, and an engineer, and they're going along with Riversong to explore a new planet that suddenly appeared at the edge of creation. This planet seems impossible, which is not to say the same impossible planet we've seen in the TV series. It seems to be outside of what physics would expect or demand for a planet to exist in our galaxy. So they're taking this experimental spaceship, which can bridge the gap between time and space, and they're trying to go to explore this planet and see what's going on. Along the way, the Seventh Doctor shows up, and he's captured in the brig on their ship. He appeared to be a stowaway, and nobody knows who he is. But he doesn't know who he is to some degree. He knows he's the Doctor. He's not really sure how he got there. And along the way, the rest of the cast is also experiencing these same memory glitches. They may know their name, they may know their function, but aside from that, they don't really know a lot of what's going on. So, River understands that things like TARDIS and the Doctor should sound familiar, but they're not really standing out to her. And similarly, the Seventh Doctor has no clue who a River Song is. So, part of the joy of this story is you get the characters at their core basics, and they're interacting in a way that is very true to the characters without maybe the baggage that would come from that situation. You're really getting to see the Seventh Doctor and River Song meet cold without all the back history of what we've experienced in the past. Now again, like I said earlier, the Seventh Doctor is my favorite, and River Song I just completely love. I mean, I think she's an amazing character. So it's really great to me to see how those characters interacted and see it's not what I expected. I really recommend this story. I hope the rest of the box set lives up to it, because I think the interaction between these two characters was phenomenal. It really defied my expectations in the best possible way. And another thing I want to kind of emphasize is, you know, again, you've got the Diary of River Song. Ideally, these should be adventures about River Song. So while the Sixth Doctor and Seventh Doctor are going to be showing up over this four-part series, I'm hoping that it follows the path of this story, The Unknown, and I hope that it keeps the emphasis on River Song. I think that's going to be what's really key. To give you a little bit more about the story, you know, there's lots of weird things going on. Time-space anomalies, things like that. Things become more severe for the crew as it goes on, and it almost feels a bit like Event Horizon. Maybe not quite so horrific, but it's along the lines of that movie. It's a little spooky at parts, it's a little creepy, and it has a strong adventure sense. Really strong characterization among the five characters you see in the story, and I'm kind of curious with the crew. I look forward to seeing them in the future stories that come up as well. So if you really like the character of River Song, I can't recommend this highly enough. Even if you're kind of just meh, you like some of the stories but you weren't really impressed with where she ended up at the end of the Moffat stuff, check this story out. They've really found a way to make River Song her own character strongly again without being so dependent on the Doctor. And that's what's great about this story is River Song is the one in charge here. She is the protagonist. The Doctor exists as a foil more than anything. So if you enjoyed River Song at any point, if you like the Seventh Doctor, I think it does him a lot of justice in this story. And he's maybe not quite so scheming as he is in several of the Seventh Doctor stories. I would give this one 8 trowels out of 10. I think it's really a good story for River Song, and I recommend it highly. So thank you for listening. I'll be back next month with another main range title, as well as possibly something from the sidelines of Doctor Who. Thanks a bunch.
Hi, welcome back to the TARDIS Library. I'm Kevin. And it's my pleasure to be looking at some recent releases from the world of Doctor Who. As we move forward into 2017, I'm hoping to expand the scope of this slot beyond just the Titan comics. Some Torchwood audios, maybe a smattering of old or new novel releases, perhaps even a surprise or two. Let's see what comes up. For now, let's start this first episode of the year with a look at the continuing adventures of the 12th Doctor. I'm slightly behind with releases, but hopefully I'll catch up soon. I'm up to issue 11 of Year 2, and it's episode 1 of a three-part adventure, Terror of the Cabinet Noir, from returning writer Robbie Morrison and artist extraordinaire Mariano Lacaustra. He's ably assisted by his team of Per Centurion and Agus Calcagno, plus Carlos Cabrera and Juan Manuel Tumburus on colours. We're back in Earth history for this story, specifically Paris in 1695 during the reign of King Louis XIV. Inside the candlelit Cathedral of Notre Dame, a French nobleman meets with the infamous Cardinal Richelieu. I'm liking the sound of this already. Protecting himself with armed henchmen, it's no use, as they're swiftly disposed of by shadowy creatures hiding in the cathedral roof, their bones picked clean in mere moments. Agreeing to enter the confessional box and reveal his sins, the nobleman soon learns that the Cardinal is less than human, as dark tendrils consume him. It's an effective cold open worthy of the TV series. You can easily imagine the theme tune crashing in as the victim's screams echo through the vastness of Notre Dame. But if you thought this is where the Doctor comes in, you'd be wrong. We're then treated to a first-person narrative, a brief, four-page history of the real-life Julie d'Aubigny, known as Mademoiselle Lemapin, a notorious swordswoman, brigand, murderer, and fugitive from justice. She's only been conditionally granted a pardon from the King because of her excellent singing voice. Now the flame-haired songstress performs at the Paris Opera, drinking away through a Mentos champagne supply and trying, and failing, to stay out of trouble. Having disposed of one of her loudest critics with a swift boot to the unmentionables, she turns on another, who resolutely stayed sitting during the curtain calls. A white-haired gentleman in a red velvet jacket. Yes, it's the Doctor, putting in an appearance at last. It turns out he's no fan of opera, as if all the previous stuff with electric guitars and punk rock concerts hadn't clued you in. Taking drunken offence, Le Malpin challenges the Doctor to an instant duel, and before you know it there's the clash of steel blades and the pair are trading blows and witty barbs across the courtyard. The fight is suddenly interrupted as a crude small bomb is thrown into the arena, and everybody dives for cover. The culprit is the sinister-looking Captain Verloc, head of the Red Guard, who rule the streets of Paris with an iron fist. Dueling is forbidden in Paris. Mademoiselle Le Malpin's life is forfeit, and the Doctor's apparently wanted for questioning. Refusing to submit, the feisty singer attacks the captain, driving him backwards and eventually piercing his chest with her sword. But Verloc just laughs, and as his eyes bleed blackness, he shouts that the darkness will consume them all. Thankfully, a blast from the trusty sonic screwdriver causes the soldier enough pain for the Doctor and his new friend to escape the Red Guard and slip into the maze of alleyways, although the men are in hot pursuit. Thinking he is the duo trapped, Verloc is stunned to find they've vanished into thin air. Of course, it's obvious they really just dematerialised in the TARDIS. Having already seen a man pierced through the heart and carry on living, Le Malpin takes the wonder of the TARDIS in her stride. But it's the Doctor who's more astonished when she reveals that the Red Guard worked for Cardinal Richelieu, a man whom the history books say should have died 50 years ago. So it's a measured, background-heavy introduction to this new historical-based storyline, with the action only really ramping up in the last third, funnily enough when the Doctor appears on the scene. Paris is of course a city that Doctor's been to many times, perhaps most memorably in the fourth Doctor story City of Death, though I don't recall him ever visiting this particular era before. Although this story sets somewhat later, it does have a real feel of those classic tales of the Three Musketeers, which I've always loved since I read the original book by Alexandre Dumas when I was young. Plus, of course, I adored that wonderful Richard Lester movie from the mid-70s, starring Oliver Reed, Michael York and Richard Chamberlain, plus a host of other familiar faces. The whole swashbuckling genre with the hero defending the downtrodden, saving the day and rescuing the damsel in distress is very appealing. I'm surprised Doctor Who hasn't attempted something like this before now. Well, outside Big Finish audio plays, anyway. It's always a fun idea when the Doctor meets historical figures, and although I've heard of Le Malpin, I'm not that familiar with her. For those who want to know more, there's a nice essay at the back of the issue about the real person behind the comics character. I think she's going to be an interesting contrast to the Doctor, and he's going to struggle to rein in her hot temper, and possibly her drinking habits. If I have one criticism, it's that her introduction's a bit info-dumpy. Devoting a full 4 pages seems a little excessive. I wish there'd been a way that they could have been broken up more without interrupting the flow of the story. Having said that, I guess we did need to know why the opera singer is so good with a sword. So perhaps it was the most pragmatic choice to get all that personal history out the way up front. On the positive side, the art used for these flashback scenes is just wonderful. A scratchy, slightly out-of-focus style in all in sepia tones, with just the bright red of the young Julie Daubigny's hair in contrast. That brings me neatly onto the art for the rest of the issue. And as expected, Marianella Claustra doesn't disappoint. There's only one splash page at the very start, so he packs in a lot of panels into the comic. And barring one or two places during the Doctor's initial confrontations with Mademoiselle Le Malpin, their panels filled with detail, which addresses some of my concerns from a few months back. Mariano's obviously done some research. Although I can't comment on the exact historical accuracy, the costumes and weapons certainly evoke the feel of the period. It's the little things that appeal to me. The fretwork on the confessional box, the varied ornate hilts on the swords offered to the Doctor, the etchings on Captain Verloc's metal epaulettes. Just lovely. The figure work is equally impressive, with Mariano starting to rival Rachel Stott with the number of expressive faces and poses he displays for the Doctor. Particular mention needs to be made this month about the colours from Carlos Cabrera. What I liked the most was actually the lighting effects. The hazy glow of the candles in Notre Dame, the dazzle of the stage in the Opera House, and the moonlit alleyways of Paris. It takes real skill, and certainly adds to the mood of the story. The best element's right near at the end, as the Doctor and his companion are pursued through the streets by the Red Guard. As they escape in the TARDIS, we don't see a dematerialisation or a vorp-vorp sound effect, just a subtle electric blue glow reflecting on the walls. Very clever. All in all, it's an excellent first part, with the feel of the modern TV series, an intriguing villain, and a mystery to solve. What more do you want from a Doctor Who comic? Bring on part two. Right, moving on to the second quick review of the month. And it's the concluding two parts of this year's event series, Supremacy of the Cybermen, from George Mann and Kevin Scott. There's a minor change on the art front, as Ivan Rodriguez and Walter Giovanni are mostly in full control. We left off after issue 3 with the four new series Doctors fighting the Cybermen on multiple fronts throughout history. And with the help of another old foe, it appears that time is being rewritten. 9 has lost Rose to cyberization in 2006. 10 is facing Cyber Kings alongside a Sontaran fleet. 11 is trapped on prehistoric Earth battling converted Silurians. And 12? He's on Gallifrey with the Cyber Leader and a returning Rassilon. And he's not going to win this time. The Cybermen are going to reshape the universe. Permanently. I really quite enjoyed the first three parts. I was excited that George Mann and his co-writer could deliver something great. An original roller coaster ride that was strong on plot and deserving of the title Event. But sadly instead, Mr. Mann continues his long run of valiant failures. Once again, it's nice idea, interesting execution, shame about the ending. We don't even get the four doctors meeting. I knew I shouldn't have got my hopes up. I mentioned in my reviews of part 1 to 3 that the writers were having fun with the lore of the series, particularly since 2005, and spinning things off in new and interesting directions. The problem is, they've also taken the worst bombastic elements of the series as well, which means the climax is a big ball of timey-wimey nonsense which steals from pretty much every season finale to date. You want a Doctor using the heart of the TARDIS? Check. A Doctor shouting wildly at nothing? Check. An enemy destroying reality and rebuilding it in their own image? Double check. A Doctor resetting time with the power of the Time Lords and just his thoughts? Check, check, and triple check. When you paint yourself into a corner and alter history so much, the reader knows that the only way out is that big old reset button. At least when Donna saved the universe from the Daleks, she lost all the memories of her travels with the Doctor. With this, there's no real sense of peril, no consequences, no repercussions. We just don't care. There are some positives. The 10th Doctor's companions Gabby and Cindy actually get to do something in issue 4. There's some nice interplay between 9 and Jackie Tyler. 11's dialogue does sound like Matt Smith could deliver it. There's a cameo from a couple of other incarnations. Small moments. With the art, well, the actors' likenesses continue to be a bit of a problem, but they just about get away with it. Although the less said about Rassilon, the better. Part of the problem may be the multiple inkers, which means there's a lack of inconsistency. There's also a bit of a Neil Adams thing going on in places, with girding faces and huge hands reaching out of the panels. The apocalyptic scenarios do at least allow the artist to indulge in a bit of over-the-top destruction, with a huge Cyber King foot crushing some poor Sontaran clone troopers. The page design's also worth mentioning. I always love a bit of overlapping panel work. Last time I also talked about the lurid colours from Nicola Riggi, and she continues in the same vein in these concluding issues. You certainly can't accuse her of not using the full paint box. Perhaps she's a little keen on the blue energy crackle effect and that obscures certain elements of the artwork. But generally, I think she comes out of the five issues having developed a unique and distinct style. In the end, then, it's an interesting series let down by what turned out to be a familiar plot and an obvious over-the-top solution. Not all big events have to be about the destruction of the universe, you know. Anyway, time to go. I'll see you next episode. Remember, the Force will be with you. Always. Rest in peace, Carrie.
Well, here we are at the end of another TARDIS library and the start of a new year. Again, welcome to 2017. Happy New Year and all of that good stuff. I wanted to close out by talking about a class novel called Joyride. Now, I've already spoken about Joyride to some degree in a past episode of the library. In fact, I read an excerpt from it to kind of give you all a feel for how... Well, not adult, but certainly young adult, the novel is, how violent it could be, and how it sort of tied in with the whole vibe of Class on television as we knew it, particularly the earlier episodes of Class, which tended to be the more violent episodes. After it got a few violent episodes out of the way, it wasn't quite as violent in future episodes. I know a lot of people who only watch the first or second episode make these broad brushstroke claims about Class, saying, oh, it's violent and everyone gets splattered with blood every episode, and that actually doesn't happen. But Joyride. I do want to finish up by saying I finished the book now. It's really, really good. If you like the characters in Class, obviously you'll love it. But even if you didn't, I think you could probably get into this story because it concentrates a lot on a person who has, and I won't try and give too many spoilers, but has discovered an alien technology and has really ruthlessly taken over that technology and is now using it for personal gain. And the classmates, or some of the classmates, kind of get involved in this quite by accident, quite by happenstance. It's not like they're actively seeking this out or investigating it or anything like that. Some of them are quite unwilling victims of this alien technology, and that's really interesting. It's quite a good story. It's the kind of story that could have popped up in Doctor Who, for example. That has happened with a few Class storylines. For example, in the television episodes, there were these killer blossoms, these beautiful cherry blossom type things that would fall from the sky and actually latch onto people and suck their blood and try and devour them. I think that would have been great in Doctor Who. That would have been a fantastic threat. But I digress. This book is well worth your time if you've been watching Class, even if you haven't, and you want to give it a go. Maybe if you didn't like Class on television, you'd actually like reading this story. That's a weird thing to say, isn't it? But possibly that's the case. Whether you'd actually shell out the money to give that a try or not is another question, just on my say-so. But if you're a reader and you like sci-fi and you like people taking alien tech and doing interesting things and, you know, characters getting into interesting situations, it's a really good, quick, easy read. It is a young adult book after all. I mean, it's got a decent page count, but the text is pretty big and it is pretty easy to read all told. So it's the kind of thing you could, if you see it for cheap, if you're curious about it, you see it for cheap, pick it up. You'll probably devour it in 1 or 2 days if you have a few good reading sessions on a commute or something like that. And let us know what you think. If you've been reading these Class novels, there are 3 of them out there, or if you do go and read this one based on this review, why not write in and tell us? Even if you're hearing this months down the track, it doesn't matter. Write in hello@thedwshow.net and tell us what you thought about it. All right, that's it. On behalf of myself, Mike and Kevin, thank you for listening. We'll be back, as I say, later in January. I'm sure there'll be some great Titan comics out by then, and our regular comic reviewers will be back. We're also going to have a number of audio reviews spread through the early months of 2017. We've very kindly been sent some audios, and they've gone out to our UK-based reviewers, and they're currently listening to them, and we'll be handing in some reviews of those. I think Kevin's already given you a bit of a tease that he'll be doing some Torchwood audios, which is very cool. But that's all in the future for now. So all that's left for me to say is, again, thank you for listening. I love doing these TARDIS Library episodes. They're something a little different. And if you like them too, why not tell a friend? Why not get other people involved? And writing in and telling us what you are thinking about Big Finish Audios, Titan Comics, Class novels. There should be a new line of Doctor Who novels out soon, probably another 3 hardbacks featuring Peter Capaldi's Doctor. That's very exciting because I love reading those from BBC Books. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff out there. So much to consume, so little time. I'll see you all next time.